Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about being disabled and trying to get through this pandemic. What are your rights? But right now, we turn to Bonnie Petrie, the bioscience and medical reporter for Texas Public Radio News, getting an update on COVID and the local response. Bonnie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks, Dave. How are you?
I'm okay. So the concern is right now about testing. It seems that I'm confused about who can get tested and the protocols.
So right now, if you are uninsured and you want free tests supplied by the city, you have to be symptomatic. That's a change. They've been testing for several weeks. Everyone who wants a test at Freeman Coliseum and the other walk up and drive up sites. That has changed. I'm not sure why, but I think that it's probably related to the number of tests and, trying to get people who are symptomatic information on whether they're positive or negative for the virus.
So we had heard that before this change, that there were people who were symptomatic. They had been sitting in their cars for hours waiting to get a test, and it's pretty horrible. I mean, it's 110 degrees outside almost, and you ache already, and you feel terrible, and here you are, they made it a priority, or is this something else about we want people who have the symptoms of COVID, which is mainly shortness of breath, aching, pains, dry cough that doesn't cease, those types of things, headaches, being able to get a test, so to try to figure out, you know, how much medical care these individuals might need, and people who are not suffering from these symptoms, but they may have come in contact with somebody who has, and asking those people to just self-quarantine until they think that they are becoming symptomatic and then get a test. Is that how that works?
Sure. I mean, I think it's probably more than treatment, although that, you know, early treatment is important with this disease and all disease. I think it's more about isolating, although if you have symptoms of COVID, whether you have a positive test or not, you should probably be isolated. We're isolated to my house right now because somebody's got symptoms. And so, you know, that's something that we need to have happen. Regardless, though, whether you're symptomatic or asymptomatic, we need to know, obviously, because we need to isolate all people because asymptomatic people can still transmit the virus, and they also can still suffer. They can suffer damage internally, even if they don't have any obvious symptoms. So really, everybody needs to know whether they have the virus or not. Still, you can't have people sitting in line, as you mentioned, in 110 degree heat for hours, which is happening across Texas and across the South and has been happening for a couple of weeks. So it's really a tough place. We may have way too many infections to effectively contact trace, which would be another reason to get people tested so that you could trace their contacts and isolate them. But it seems like we may be too far into this right now to do effective contact tracing on any large scale.
We're also hearing that people do not just show up at Joe Freeman Coliseum, that they need to make an appointment. So we've seen that messaging.
Right. Yeah. So, and you can do that on the Metro Health app. And it's pretty easy. But you can't just show up at Freeman Coliseum and expect a test. As a reporter, I can't just show up and expect to go in. They have people there that will tell you, you know, if you don't have an order from your doctor, you can't come in. Or if you don't have an order from Metro Health, you can't come in. But you can get that order from Metro Health by going to the Metro Health website, filling out their screening survey there, and then you can get approved to go to Freeman Coliseum.
So people who just show up at Freeman Coliseum expecting to get a COVID test are going to be turned away. People need to know that. You have to get an appointment in order to get the test. Now, you interviewed the STRAT director, Eric Epley, last week about hospital capacity. What did he tell you?
Well, he said last week, and it remains true this week, our hospital system in this region, which is as big as West Virginia, 22 counties, is extremely stressed right now. And he says if rates continue to increase at the rate they've been increasing, then we could see a crisis in a week or two. He said probably two, but a week or two. And I asked what that means, and you kind of have to corner people on this because nobody can really imagine what that means. So what that means is, you know, sending patients out of state if other states have room, or opening up other facilities and putting beds there. But like I stressed in the Petri Dish podcast that we did last week, you can have as many beds as you want. Beds are just pieces of furniture, right? You can get hundreds of beds. They're just pieces of furniture, though, if you don't have critical care staff and equipment to surround them. And that's the issue that we're facing. Now, thankfully, we've had a bit of decline over the last couple of days, at least in San Antonio. So hopefully the mask mandate in businesses that we were able to put into effect a couple of weeks ago has been having some effect. This is, you know, positive cases and hospitalizations, they're all lagging indicators. So whatever behaviors occur at a certain point, you'll start to see that pan out in the healthcare system in, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks. So we may be seeing the mask mandates and businesses helping out with our case numbers, but then we had 4th of July weekend this weekend. So, I mean, like Eric Apley always says, capacity is a moving target. You know, you get more beds. They've asked for nearly 1,000 nurses from the state and the federal government. So we could get more beds tomorrow, but then we could fill those beds. Capacity, again, it's a moving target.
Now, if a family has individuals, this is a problem that a lot of people are afraid of. If you have a family, everyone's sheltering in place at the house, but then someone there starts to get sick, and you don't know, do they have the COVID? Is it something else? What kind of options would that family unit have to do to figure out what's the best way forward?
Well, if you have somebody in your house with symptoms of COVID, then act like they have COVID. Now, that's just my advice. That is not from a medical professional that I've interviewed. That's my advice. So isolate them in your home and try to access testing for them. If you have insurance and a doctor, call your primary care doctor. They will tell you what to do. If you're uninsured, get on the Metro Health website and they will help you figure out how to get a free test at one of the at Freeman or one of the other facilities. But until you know for sure, you're going to have to act like that person in your house has COVID and isolate them from the rest of the family and then watch the rest of the family too.
Yeah, that can be really tough when everyone is in, you know, we don't live in gigantic houses. You know, we don't have separate bathrooms for every member of the household. It's, you know, frequently you have a multi, you know, 2.5 bedrooms and one bathroom, you know, and everyone's got to live together.
Yeah. And that advice is not going to work for everybody. So you're going to have to do the best you can. You know, wash your hands, try not to wear a mask. The person in my house who may be infected has been wearing a mask. They're mostly isolated, but when they leave the isolation area, they wear a mask. You know, keep your hands clean, all that other stuff, that personal COVID hygiene that we've been schooled on since March is the stuff you got to do.
Bonnie Petri is the bioscience and medical reporter for TPR News. She has a podcast that's taking some incredible deep looks at what is happening with the latest science and impact of COVID-19. You should check it out. It's called Petri Dish. Bonnie, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, David.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about disability rights in this pandemic. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio News. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When Michael Hixon needed a ventilator, he didn't get one. Hixon was a 46-year-old African-American father of five from Austin, Texas, and he was sick with COVID-19. He was also a quadriplegic and had brain damage, and the doctor at St. David's South Austin Medical Center declined to continue medical care, saying it was a quality of life issue. Here's audio of Michael's wife, Melissa Hixon, pleading with the doctor to help her husband.
So as far as the room disability, if it's a certain criteria, and it's not that we're afraid of side effects, it's that you have to fit a certain criteria. And right now that criteria is requiring an intubation, so if you were to get intubated, then he would be on it. But at this point, with the decision is, do we want to be extremely aggressive with his care, or do we want? Do we feel like this will be futile? And the big question of futility is one that we always question. The issue is, will this help him improve his quality of life? Will this help him improve anything? And will it ultimately change the outcome? And the thought is, the answer is no to all of those.
But what would make you say no to all of those?
Because as of right now, his quality of life, he doesn't have much of one.
What do you mean?
So these
because he's paralyzed with a brain injury, he doesn't have quality of life.
Correct.
Michael Hickson's sister, who is also a doctor, agreed with the primary doctor's decision, and so did the agency acting as Michael Hickson's legal guardian. Still, this case is raising serious questions and protests about what kind of medical care those with disabilities will receive in the pandemic. What is the law? What about medical ethics and an ableist bias about questions of quality of life? And when do we make these life and death decisions as in an informed way without a bias or prejudice against those who are disabled? Are you or a loved one living with a disability, and are you concerned about what's happening with COVID-19? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined for the remainder of the hour with Sean Jackson, supervising attorney for Disability Rights Texas. And Sean, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And also with us is Dr. Lisa Iozzoni, the professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and associate director of the Health Policy Research Center at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Iozzoni, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Jackson, what happened with Michael Hickson?
Well, let me say that Disability Rights Texas, the agency that I'm working for, we are aware of the Michael Hickson case. We are investigating it. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to comment on an open investigation. That's not my just saying that. It's just that we have certain rules that we have to abide by because we have what's called PNA Access Authority, and there are certain aspects of things we can get through that authority that we have through the federal government that requires that we keep certain elements of what we get private and confidential. But I can say this. We are aware of the statements that were made in the recording you just played. We've heard it. We are actively investigating it, as I stated. And we think they are indicative of widely held beliefs and biases in the medical community about the quality of life of people with disabilities. There's been study after study that has shown that doctors and other medical professionals consistently undervalue the quality of life experienced by persons with disabilities. And this is a flawed evaluation, I should say, because it's often misguided. It's often guided by a misguided paternalism in that we look at a person who has a disability and we don't see them. We don't see the person first. We see the disability first. So just in general, if you're talking about somebody like a Mr. Hickson, if you have someone that, you know, for instance, that's a quadriplegic or they have some other kind of a condition, we tend to, we see sometimes medical professionals, they tend to undervalue that person's quality of life, and then they make a determination that person is not in need of the same type of medical care that a person without a disability would get. This is a violation in many cases. I'm not speaking about Mr. Hickson's particular case, but that sort of a blanket approach that a person with a disability's life has less value or they shouldn't receive care is oftentimes a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, in that there's clear guidance that says if you read through that act and the rules, that you cannot just make those type of blanket evaluations. So, again, I can't speak about Mr. Hickson individually, but I can say that it is concerning that anytime a medical professional just decides that if someone has a certain disability, that they're literally not, it's not worth going through the problem of the cost of saving them. You have to look at the person themselves. Again, you can't look at the disability. So,
sure. So let me ask Dr. Lisa Iazzoni about that. How are doctors, what is the expectation that a doctor who will approach a patient, they're saying this is an individual with COVID, they need a ventilator, there's only one ventilator left, there's four or five people who need it, this person has a disability. How do they weigh all that? What are the expectations?
Well, first of all, I agree with Sean that people with disability, the disability should not be taken into consideration when making the medical decision, because the ADA very clearly states that people with disabilities should get the same quality care, equal care, as people without disability. Now, Dave, you kind of posited the question like, okay, we've got five people waiting for a ventilator. Who do we decide who should get it? That is a really hard question because there's so many characteristics in our society that are stigmatized. You talk to people who are LGBTQ and they will say, you know, we're afraid that people are going to evaluate our lives and say that we should not get the same kind of care if there's only one ventilator for five people. So this, I don't know what's happening in Texas. And so maybe Sean would have a better sense of this, but there are rules that are called crisis standards of care. And they have, in the best of circumstances, been put together by groups of people that include patient populations. So they would include people with disability, along with medical professionals, along with medical ethicists, as well as kind of hospital facilities. And preferably this would have been done pre-pandemic, so in the coolness of people not facing these kind of life and death situations as you are now. And these crisis standards of care have been what have historically been thought to guide these decisions. What we are finding, though, now in the COVID crisis is that now that these crisis standards of care are being unpacked a little bit, is that they do sometimes include biasing statements about disability. And so, Sean, maybe I could pause for a second and see whether you know whether that's the case in Texas, whether you've got crisis standards of care that might have that concern.
Yeah, we have seen that, and we have seen one that we're aware of in the North Texas area. There's some crisis standards of care that we feel are lacking as far as making sure that the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act are applied.
Well Sean, let me ask you a specific question in that regard. We heard the doctor on the tape say the word futile and in describing the efforts that it would take to try to save Michael Hickson. Now, not talking about Michael Hickson's case, but there is a thing called the Texas Futility Law, and he seemed to be leaning on that. Can you tell us what that is?
I'll admit I'm not as quite as familiar with that. I'm not an expert on that, but I'm aware of it. My understanding of that law is that if it's been determined that providing care to any person would be futile, that at some point the hospital has the ability to withdraw the treatment. So I've seen that come into play with there's ethics panels that I've seen a hospital can convene and withdraw treatment and whatnot. So again, I'm not an expert on that, and I don't want to hold myself out as that, but that's what I'm aware of. But I know that that is a issue with these types of particular cases. But I think what we're looking at more is the attitude of that we can, again, looking at the disability first and not the person, and making the determination that because of the quality of life will not be enough, that is futile. again, I'm not going to comment specifically about Mr. Hixon because we're still investigating that. But I think the issue is that do those become conflated? For instance, if a physician decides it's futile because this person, you know, again, is a quadriplegic or whatever, that their life is not worth living, then again, you're looking at the disability first, and that is the absolute wrong analysis. So I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Well, it seems like, you know, the Texas futility law is something that doctors are well aware of, particularly in emergency rooms and these types of settings. But I don't know if their awareness is actually in focus with what the law actually says and whether or not this is being provided as a blank check. So for doctors who see someone and they can just say it's futile and they can lean on that and not really have to justify what has happening. So really what I'm trying to get at, you know, with this program, as we talk about disability and the pandemic, are the rights of the disabled in the pandemic, particularly when it comes to seeking life-saving medical care, and also how people can clarify what the expectations are. And it seems that what the medical community has been told about this situation has been muddled, and there isn't a lot of clear direction coming from the governor and from the Texas Medical Association about what are the rights and what needs to be done in these situations. So, I mean, can you talk to that, Sean?
Yeah, I would agree with that. The message is muddled. One thing we have done is that we have sent out letters to pretty much every hospital that we're aware of asking for how are they looking at this medical rationing issue. And we are also asking for the state to give out clear guidance to these particular hospitals as to how they are going to deal with this issue, because it affects our clients, right? Persons with disabilities. And of course we want the guidance to, we understand about the futility law and all of that, but we want them to understand the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that given that we are hearing these anecdotal stories about people having care not being provided because they're feeling like, wow, you know, we've got, and let me say this, we understand that these physicians and hospitals are in a tough position. They're literally being overrun. But none of that still does away with the protections of the ADA and making sure that folks are not, that disability analysis is not done incorrectly, where they're looking at a person deciding it's not worth, their quality of life will not be enough to get this type of care. So we think that we would like to see a clear guidance. They are the Office of Civil Rights, actually, the federal office has issued guidance to other states. We are asking for that to happen for Texas, and so that these hospitals and these healthcare professionals can have this type of guidance so they can make these decisions.
Right, and we can address questions of medical bias viewed from an ableism point of view, trying to make judgments about quality of life, which is something they absolutely know nothing about when it comes to a person who is dealing with these issues. So we're going to take a break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're talking about the rights of the disabled in a pandemic. Stay tuned.
A filmmaker sought out to make a documentary about the progressive wave in Texas. The film kept taking unexpected turns.
The film really shows that struggle of, like, you kind of set out, you're going to look at this kind of bigger story, but then reality happens and it just kept pulling me back down to the border.
Kevin Ford talks about the pushback next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio News. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the rights of the disabled in the pandemic and how medical doctors are not sometimes seeing them as an individual who needs medical care. They're seeing them as someone who is disabled and that they may not deserve the same medical care as other people. We saw this before in this case of Michael Hicks in Austin, who in June was declined being able to have a ventilator and he died. He was a quadriplegic and had brain damage. You have a question or a comment about you, about your family and you, if you have a disability, are you concerned that if you turn up at the ER, you have COVID-19 and you may not be treated as someone who can be saved? You may fall under this Texas futility law, whatever that is. You know, are you worried about that? Do you need some clarity? Do you want doctors to be informed that there is this American, the ADA, means it's illegal for you to be treated that way? Well, what are your rights and how do you protect them? Call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we do have a voicemail.
Yes, my name is John, and I have a seven-month-old baby at home who has a lot of health issues. Grouped together, it's known as VACTERL, V-A-C-T-E-R-L Association. And ever since my job ended its furlough back in May, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't worry about bringing something from my job back home to my daughter. The steps that I go through, which is, you know, making sure that any and all clothes I come home in go to a separate laundry bin, taking a shower immediately, sanitizing, you know, it's crazy. And the more and more people I hear about and see at work getting sick and going out on quarantine, paid quarantine from work, because of their sickness, they were, like I said, the anxiety is starting to pile up, I must tell you.
I hear that. Thank you for that call, John. Dr. Lisa Iazzoni, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, associate director of the Health Policy Research Center at Massachusetts General Hospital. The issue with those who are disabled is that they are virtually invisible in our society, and that but you know, they have loved ones that are interacting in our society who can catch the COVID and then bring it home, or caregivers. They're very vulnerable in a tangential kind of way, and so you hear from John how anxious he is about being the vector that brings COVID home.
Can I just clarify for you one thing, Dave?
Yeah.
I have had multiple sclerosis for 44 years, and I use a wheelchair.
Okay.
Okay, so I am also a person with a disability, and my husband is a hematologist-oncologist at the local hospital here, and so he does the exact same thing. You know, I work at home all the time because I do research, and so I can do that from my home, but he's terrified of bringing home coronavirus to me. So he gets off, you know, gets out in the garage, comes through the basement, strips down, goes right into the shower. And so, yeah, I mean, this is happening to everybody. And I think that the people with disability who require, for example, home health aides to come in to help them with activities of daily living, you know, maybe getting them up in the morning, getting them showered and fed, they don't know whether the person who's coming into their home is safe, doesn't have COVID, because often the home health aides aren't being tested for that. And they almost never have personal protective equipment. And so that is a really, really big problem. We're seeing that up here in the Northeast where I am, where we had our COVID surge back, you know, in April. And so it's just heartbreaking hearing what's happening down there. It just feels like PTSD for me to hear about the stories you're going through.
So Dr. Iazzoni, in a mobility chair living with MS, are you concerned that if you had to go to the ER suddenly, that you would be seen first as a person who is disabled and not as a patient who can be saved?
You know, I'm also a researcher, and so I know for a fact, we've recently done a survey of doctors, that the vast majority of doctors view quality of life of people with disability as worse. And so I've been kind of dealing with this for many, many years in the medical profession, because my colleagues, if they don't know who I am, don't look me in the eye as I'm rolling around in the hall. They kind of look straight over my head. You know, so I think that even pre-COVID, I've had a very great sense that of disrespect by the medical profession in general of people with disability. If I were to go to the hospital now with coronavirus, first of all, I'm kind of really data-driven, and I know what the chances of survival are with a ventilator. They're not great. They're really not great. And I also know that Texas, in a way, is a little luckier than we were in Massachusetts, because you've been able to see what happened in New York, what happened in New Jersey, how well ventilation worked. It doesn't necessarily work that well. And, you know, having people do more kind of high-pressure oxygen rather than putting people on vents might be the best way to go. So I think I would probably tend to really look very seriously at what my chances of survival would be given everything else that would be going on with me. And let me also just emphasize and underscore that the respiratory problems are not the only problem with COVID. We're seeing lots of strokes. We're seeing heart problems. We're seeing so many other conditions, including incredible delirium because of the clotting factors of COVID. And so I think the ventilators are a place to start, but it's more whether people are getting good all-around medical care, looking at every aspect of their functioning.
And also we need to be talking about how to stop the spread of COVID and get more people to understand that they are the vector. Let's go to Peter on the phones. Peter, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Peter. I guess my question is, the whole idea of withholding care from somebody with a disability seems absurd to me. And I wonder, to shift a little bit, of using the idea of someone's masking preference as a factor in determining whether or not to withhold care, such as a person who has declared in some fashion that they don't believe in wearing masks, they would be put lower on the totem pole, so to speak.
Okay. Peter, thank you for that call. Sean Jackson, supervising attorney for Disability Rights Texas. This is outside of your wheelhouse, but as an attorney, I would imagine that it would be unethical, if not illegal, for a doctor to refuse care for someone who, because they refused to wear a mask and then they got COVID and they showed up at the ER, they still had to be treated like anyone else.
Yeah, that's correct, Dave. And also you have there's another thing with the mask is that that would be complicated to try to do anything like that. I think it would be illegal, but also you may have somebody with a disability. Maybe they're having difficulties breathing and they're claiming that's why they don't want to wear a mask. I don't think that's workable, but I do think that, I think what you said is correct. In fact, it is correct that the best thing we can do is to try to follow all of the guidance and, as far as wearing our masks properly, maintaining social distancing, whatnot, because as the doctor stated, that if you do wind up in a hospital, it is probably the last place you want to be. And another thing I'd like to point out is that another issue that we're starting to see is as the hospitals are being overrun, so to speak, with all of these patients that are trying to get in, there's another issue even before you get to the withholding care, is that the ability to get into these hospitals is going to be a bigger issue. And we live in Texas, 100 degree heat in many places. We have a big concern about how do we look at trying to get our clients to get in when they are not going to be able to sit in line or wait in emergency rooms for 6 hours or more because they're medically fragile. And we know that's something that's happened in other places that precede us with this epidemic, like in New York or whatnot. So we're concerned about that as well. So.
And Sean Jackson with Disability Rights Texas, you're an advocate for those who have disabilities. And what about protesting We're in an era right now where people are out and about in the streets, but people who are dealing with disabilities are not really have that privilege. How do you assert yourself in this age?
Well, you're saying how you can protest without being in the streets? Is that the question?
Well, I mean, it seemed like everybody's yelling about something, and we need, and there's a lot of people have great causes. And of course, I'm not trying to diminish that. I'm just saying, though, how do you make sure that the rights of the disabled are able to have attention?
Well, I think that we're in an electronic age, a digital age. I think there are other ways that persons with disabilities, assuming they have access to that type of digital media, they can make their voices heard. Of course, you know, our organization, while we're not allowed to lobby, and we do not lobby, but we are always open to, if a legislator or whatnot asked us to come and give information and testify or write a report or something or give any type of information about what's going on with our particular client population, that's something we can do. And there are a lot of groups with disabilities who have organized themselves and are doing.
Sure, like ADAPT. They're out there. All right, so I'm going to take a break here, but also when we come back from the break, I want to talk about how the economy and what's happening with COVID, with evictions and of discrimination at work, with how this is also part of disability impact in this pandemic. The number is 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the rights of the disabled in the pandemic. And you can call in if you have a question or comment. Number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Are you concerned about your health or someone in your family who is dealing with a disability, and how would they be treated if they ended up at the ER? But there's all these other questions as well, as we're dealing with the fallout of the economy with COVID-19. We know that there's a discrimination at work is a real thing. It's not supposed to be, but it does happen with those who are disabled. Sean Jackson, supervising attorney with Disability Rights Texas, as we're seeing this downturn, is that a concern?
Yes, as always, let's say this, that persons with disabilities are going to be discriminated against without a pandemic. I think what you see with this pandemic is that a lot of the cracks in our society in regards to our attitudes and how we treat those individuals, it's being exposed more. So yeah, it's a major concern. In regards to, there's all kinds of ways we're seeing it. There's going to be discrimination, as you mentioned before the break, with employment. There's going to be discrimination with housing. And then there's going to be just the stigma of that a person with a disability may be more likely, although there's nothing founded in this, may be more likely to have the virus or regarded as having the virus. That, again, has nothing to support that, but that we're going to see all types of discrimination as far. I mean, we are seeing it where people are being treated differently, but they're treated differently anyway, unfortunately. So, yeah, this is a problem.
And so Dr. Lisa Iazzoni, you mentioned earlier, you're a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, that you're a data person. Are we getting enough data about how COVID is impacting those with disabilities?
Dave, we're getting no data. We're absolutely getting no data whatsoever. There are no data collected about disability. And I just wanted to make the point that there is just an enormous intersectionality with race and ethnicity around disability as well. And we do know that there are data coming out. I don't know whether in Texas this is true, but certainly in the northeastern states it's been really horribly true that racial and ethnic black and brown communities have had much higher rates of not only the disease, but also dying from the disease. And we see a lot higher rates of disabilities in the Black and brown communities as well. And so you've got both kind of strikes against you, if you will, if you want to call it that, in this pandemic. You've got that intersectionality of both race and ethnicity. But no, there are no data being collected about disability, and there never have been. It just hasn't been something that the healthcare system has collected ever.
And what conclusions do you draw from the fact that this is not something that is being monitored, Doctor?
It's pushed under the rug. You know, this is something that I've been fussing about for years and years and years and years and years. And so, I mean, there's a very active online group of us fussing about getting disability data and data on race and ethnicity. And I think that we're getting more traction on the race and ethnicity data. The New York Times yesterday came out with some data that they got through Freedom of Information Act that I think was very, very powerful.
Sure, but when you looked at that map, Texas was blank.
Well, okay.
And that was because Texas does not release that information by counties. It releases it by the state, so it's basically not helpful.
I'm sorry I didn't look at Texas. I should have looked at Texas.
Well, it was a big blank thing at the center of the bottom of the country. Mm. So, yeah, it's still a lot of work to be done there. Let me get Bill on the phone, on the air here. He's called in. Hey, Bill, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is really simple-minded, and it's simply this. Is it really that negative that we don't care? I'm a retired medical professional, and I find it hard to believe that we've reached a point where we just don't care about disabled people. Could it possibly be that in the emergency room especially, it's more about triage, about, you know, and anybody that's on your panel, and I'm sure you do too, know triage is about aligning the patients in order of priority. And ultimately, in the end, it's about who we can save and who we can't save.
Bill, thank you so much for your call. And let's go first to Dr. Lisa Iazzoni.
It's a great question. And the issue about triage is actually a very critical question, because I don't know what the rules are in Texas, but the Joint Commission that accredits hospitals requires hospitals to have triage committees. And triage committees are supposed to be made up of ethicists and people who will not be biased in the ways that they make decisions. And so we're not theoretically supposed to be having like an individual doc just sitting there and saying that this person isn't going to get a ventilator. Like, I don't know. Again, we can't talk about Mr. Hickson's case in specifics, but that isn't supposed to be the case, that a single doc can just decide and flip a coin and say that this one person isn't going to get it. They're supposed to be committees of people that very carefully study decisions that inevitably could result in life or death. And so, again, I would kind of throw that back to see what happens in Texas around whether you've got the crisis standards of care in place that would give you objective criteria, quote unquote, to say who should be given a scarce resource and who are the people who are supposed to make those decisions. Is there indeed a triage committee for each hospital that's supposed to calmly and judiciously make those kind of decisions?
And Sean Jackson, supervising attorney for Disability Rights Texas, it sounds like we're hearing that triage is going to happen. We have to make decisions. But what we don't want to see is just because an individual is disabled that they are automatically not even considered. Is that the question?
That is the question, and that is the concern. And again, I think what the concern is, or the issue, is that these things get conflated. If you spoke earlier about the futility law, you know, where you have an ethics panel at presume somebody decides whether or not they should override the person's wishes and withdraw their care. We have the, as Lisa said, the triage committees that are determining what are the standards and should be in place. But we also are still talking about human beings that are doing these jobs, and human beings that are bringing their own attitudes and biases and predispositions about certain individuals. And I think that the concern is that it gets conflated with making a sound medical decision with some predisposed notion that this person's value, their quality of life is not worth them, we expending the resources on it.
We have
I think that,
We have an email from John. Thank you for thinking about us. A lack of transportation means I can't line up in a car for testing or to get food. Also an email from Pamela. Disabled veterans that are not currently able to report to work or suffering. We are at home on doctor's orders to shelter in place. Many of us, such as myself, have exhausted all forms of paid leave. We're now facing eviction. Many of us are eligible for reasonable accommodations from our employers and landlords, but have not been granted it. Sean Jackson, first off, evictions. What are the protections for people who are disabled with evictions?
Well, anyone that has a disability can also always request a reasonable accommodation, as was stated in the email, that that could be a reasonable accommodation as far as having additional time to pay rent or whatnot. And let me say this, if you don't mind, I would like to give out our information because I think what we would like is for people, as they're seeing these particular issues, to please contact us. And if you don't mind, I'd like to give out our number.
Sure.
1-800-252-9108. I'll say that again, 1-800-252-9108. You can also apply, and you can call that number between the hours of 9 a.m. and 4 p.m., but you can also apply online anytime at intake.drtx.org, intake.drtx.org. You can also go to our website, which is just drtx.org, and we have a really good resource which answers a lot of these questions as far as what a person's rights with COVID-19. We have, it's called a special COVID-19 resource page. There's so many issues, we couldn't even begin to cover them in this little, a short amount of time.
Dr. Lisa Iazzoni, when you see people not wearing masks and refusing to wear a mask to, in the community, does that concern you, that you feel that there's a chain of events that it could lead back to you or someone like you?
I'm in Massachusetts. It's a little different up here. I mean, there certainly are people who don't wear masks, and most of them, frankly, are young kids. But the adults around here are mostly wearing masks. They really are. So I know that there are some exceptions to that, and it is very disturbing. And you just have to wear your own mask. But I think that our governor, you know, who's a Republican, Charlie Baker, has really sent a very systematic and consistent message, literally day after day after day after day, about that we have to care for other people in our community. And it's just kind of gotten through.
And we have about 30 seconds. Sean Jackson, what would you like to hear from Governor Abbott? Do you want him to be clear to the medical community about being fair and not writing off people who are disabled in the ER?
Yes, so we definitely want to hear that. And we would also, again, like to hear a consistent message that's based on medical guidance, period, as far as everything with this particular pandemic. But yes, that would be great if we could get that.
Sean Jackson, Supervising Attorney for Disability Rights Texas. Thank you, Dr. Lisa Iazzoni, Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.